Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 7, Chapter 3. And it goes a little something like this. The weather was already growing wintry, and morning frosts congealed on an earth saturated by autumn rains. The verdure had thickened, and its bright green stood out sharply against the brownish strips of winter rye trodden down by the cattle, and against the pale yellow stubble of the spring sowing and the reddish strips of buckwheat. The wooded ravines and the copses, which at the end of August had still been green islands amid black fields and stubble, had become golden and bright red islands amid the green winter rye. The hares had already half changed their summer coats, the fox cubs were beginning to scatter, and the young wolves were bigger than dogs. It was the best time of year for the chase. The hounds of that ardent young sportsman Rostov had not merely reached hard winter condition, but were so jaded that at a meeting of the huntsmen it was decided to give them a 3 days' rest, and then, on the 15th of September, to go on a distant expedition, starting from the oak grove where there was an undisturbed litter of wolf cubs. All that day the hounds remained at home. It was frosty and the air was sharp, but towards evening the sky became overcast and it began to thaw. On the 15th, when young Rostov in his dressing gown looked out of the window, he saw it was an unsurpassable morning for hunting. It was as if the sky were melting and sinking to the earth without any wind. The only motion in the air was that of the dripping, microscopic particles of drizzling mist. The bare twigs in the garden were hung with transparent drops which fell on the freshly fallen leaves. The earth in the kitchen garden looked wet and black and glistened like poppy seed, and at a short distance merged into the dull, moist veil of mist. Nicholas went out into the wet and muddy porch. There was a smell of decaying leaves and of dog. Milka, a black-spotted, broad-haunched bitch with prominent black eyes, got up on seeing her master, stretched her hind legs, lay down like a hare, and then suddenly jumped up and licked him right on the nose and moustache. Another borzoi, a dog, catching sight of his master from the garden path, arched his back, and rushing headlong towards the porch with lifted tail began rubbing himself against his legs. Ohoy! Came at that moment that inimitable huntsman's call which unites the deepest bass with the shrillest tenor. And round the corner came Daniel, the head huntsman and head kennelman, a grey wrinkled old man with hair cut straight over his forehead, Ukrainian fashion, a long bent whip in his hand, and that look of independence and scorn of everything that is only seen in huntsmen. He doffed his Circassian cap to his master and looked at him scornfully. His scorn was not offensive to his master. Nicholas knew that this Daniel, disdainful of everybody, and who considered himself above them, was all the same his serf and huntsman. "Daniel," Nicholas said timidly, conscious at the sight of the weather, the hounds, and the huntsmen, that he was being carried away by that irresistible passion for sport which makes a man forget all his previous resolutions, as a lover forgets in the presence of his mistress. "What orders, Your Excellency?" said the huntsman in his deep bass, deep as a pro deacon's and hoarse with hallowing. And two flashing black eyes gazed from under his brows at his master, who was silent. "Can you resist it?" those eyes seemed to be asking. "It's a good day, eh? For a hunt and a gallop, eh?" asked Nicholas, scratching Milka behind the ears. Daniel did not answer, but winked instead. "I sent Yuvarka at dawn to listen," his bass boomed out after a minute's pause. "He says she's moved them into the Otradnoe enclosure. They were howling there." This meant that the she-wolf, about whom they both knew, had moved with her cubs to the Otradnoe copse, a small place 2 versts from the house. "We ought to go, don't you think so?" said Nicholas. "Come to me with Overka." as you please. Then put off feeding them. Yes, sir. 5 minutes later, Daniel and Averka were standing in Nicholas's big study, though Daniel was not a big man. To see him in a room was like seeing a horse or a bear on the floor among the furniture and surroundings of human life. Daniel himself felt this, and as usual stood just inside the door, trying to speak softly and not move for fear of breaking something in the master's apartment, and he hastened to say all that was necessary, so as to get from under the ceiling out into the open under the sky once more. Having finished his inquiries and extorted from Daniel an opinion that the hounds were fit, Daniel himself wished to go hunting, Nicholas ordered the horses to be saddled, but just as Daniel was about to go, Natasha came in with rapid steps, not having done up her hair or finished dressing, and with her old nurse's big shawl wrapped around her. Petya ran in at the same time. "You are going?" asked Natasha. "I knew you would. Sonya said you wouldn't go, but I knew that today is the sort of day when you couldn't help going." "Yes, we are going," replied Nicholas reluctantly, for today, as he intended to hunt seriously, he did not want to take Natasha and Petya. "We are going, but only wolf hunting. It would be dull for you." "You know it is my greatest pleasure," said Natasha. "It's not fair. You are going by yourself, having the horses saddled, and said nothing to us about it." "No barrier bars a Russian's path. We'll go," shouted Petya. "But you can't. Mama said you mustn't," said Nicholas to Natasha. "Yes, I'll go. I shall certainly go," said Natasha decisively. "Daniel, tell them to saddle for us, and Michael must come with my dogs," she added to the huntsman. It seemed to Daniel irksome and improper to be in a room at all, but to have anything to do with a young lady seemed to him impossible. He cast down his eyes and hurried out as if it were none of his business, careful as he went not to inflict any accidental injury on the young lady. All right, there we have it, another chapter down, and it looks like young Rostov, Nicholas Rostov, is going off on a hunt with his friend. What's his friend's name? I can't remember. Daniel, it was. His huntsman. And I like that just at the end how his two siblings, his younger brother and his younger sister, insisted on tagging along. Very relatable. Now, you know, just recently I was thinking, this book doesn't have a very vivid sense of setting. Especially in the Petersburg chapters and the Moscow chapters. No, at no point in this book have I really had a particularly vivid image in my head of what the surrounding places look like. In the war settings a little bit more, I was able to picture the countryside and the little villages and that kind of thing. But Petersburg, you know, in my head I'm like, is it a city? Is it a town? Is it, how big is it? What does it look like? I only really know from pictures that I've seen. But this first few paragraphs of this chapter went into some pretty vivid description. Turtle Vader asked, "Is Tolstoy trying to communicate anything more than flowery description with the opening paragraphs of this chapter, especially with the focus of the autumnal season?" De Fleury said, "Now that you mention it, the glorious end of summer with no fear of inevitable winter is parallel to the Rostov financial situation." Could be. You know, autumn's the most beautiful season. I think it's the most beautiful season. But it's also the season that's getting you ready for the cool, dark, death-like chill of winter. So it's a harbinger of, you know, darkness and coldness. Harvester of Baobab said, "The first paragraph killed me. It's so different than those with plot. I attempted to read it like 5 times because I was just daydreaming about something else. There just nothing happens. And then there's an entire page more of nothing happening. I feel like I am in the war part again, except I'm not." I didn't really feel that this chapter dragged on at all, personally. I thought that the description was nice, and it went on for a page or so, not even a page, but I thought it was quite pleasant. I didn't find it boring at all. Brian E. Denton has assured us through his Medium blog about this chapter, which is definitely worth reading if you can go over to medium.com and look up Brian A. Denton, that the next few chapters, we go along with Rostov on his hunting journey. And he said that at his first read, he kind of skimmed through those chapters, the next few chapters. But now that he's read the book a few times, he said he sees these as some of the most important chapters for Rostov's story. So I'm interested to see how the next few chapters play out. Turtle Vader also asked, how do you think Natasha and possibly young Petya going on the hunt will affect the outcome? Who knows how the outcome will be affected, but De Fleury said, I'm stunned. I'd never have suspected singing, dancing daughter Natasha to have such a desire to go out at the crack of dawn and hunt dangerous wolves. Maybe Denisov was her ideal mate after all. De Fleury is also predicting a realistic horse-related tragedy, and assumes that they are riding horses in this hunt and there's a chance for one of the Rostov kids to fall off and die horribly. So there's a pretty cool prediction. I hope that doesn't happen, though. I like the Rostov family, so I don't want to see them die horribly in a horse-related tragedy. Anyway, that's going to do us for today. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.